Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, making science and technology interesting, entertaining, and accessible. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host, John Wells. Today in the program, we'll weave the story of psychology and social media, along with the man who calls himself the Internet Doctor. It's Jay Izzo. Jay is a social mediaologist and helps businesses and entrepreneurs get into the psyche of the consumer on social media and beyond.
And then it's the newest graduate certificate program at the University of Utah. It's from the University of Utah's Engineering Department, Computer Science, and it's a graduate certificate program in, are you ready? Big data analysis. Lynn, I love big data.
I know you do.
And we'll speak with Jeff Phillips, professor of computer science and coordinator of the new program. He says that processing and analyzing large stores of data is becoming increasingly difficult, and we need to have better tools.
That's all coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. We'll be back after these words. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
I'm John Wells.
I'm Peggy Ijams.
Join us Friday at 9 a.m. on The Morning Mix.
Yeah, we've got musical group Small House Strings joining us. Why is everyone headed down to Salt Lake tomorrow? We'll have the answer. And it's all women, and it's at the Kimball Arts Center. We'll tell you about it.
Friday at 9 a.m. on The Morning Mix. Brought to you by Utah Olympic Park, Wasatch Brew Pub, and Squatters Roadhouse Grill and Pub.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, consider this, John. I mean, and I know you do. Should we have both a Facebook account and a website for our business? Do we need to tweet? What about things like Pinterest and Instagram? And there are so many modes of social media that we may adapt from our personal lives to our business lives and not really know what the correct application is. That's when our next guest, social mediaologist and self-proclaimed internet doctor Jay Izzo comes in. He's an experimental psychologist and he'll tell us that the key is to really know our consumer, which is a concept that, of course, is not foreign to anyone in business. But when it comes to social media, we're not equipped with the know-how to suss out which platforms our consumers use. Thank goodness Jay Izzo joins us now to uncover the how-tos of social media. He's written a new book called Got Social Mediology. Internet Doctor Jay Izzo, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks, John.
Well, it's nice to have you. So first of all, we know that from this point on in our lives, we won't be able to do without a social mediologist. But first, maybe you should explain what it is that a social mediologist does.
Yeah, well, social mediology is a term I coined, which is the study of social media from the psychological perspective of the user. In the social media, the sociological perspective and cultural perspective of each platform, because each platform we have to think of as a separate culture with its own language and its own unwritten rules, norms, and expectations. And rather than having businesses spend money on marketing dollars, let's look at the psychology of each of these platforms and let's interact appropriately and get the best return.
Right. You know, it's interesting. I would say maybe 15 years ago, say, you know, each small business said, well, gosh, I guess I better get a website. And a lot of times they didn't know exactly why they were getting a website. And still to this day, I looked something up the other day to just try to find the hours that a business was open. And on their very simple website, not such, you know, such basic information wasn't even there. So still, we are, you know, we're playing catch up depending upon, I suppose, the generation we come from and the type of business we have, right?
Yeah, well, I think that's a large part of it, I think, is it's a generational thing. But some of us were early adapters, and so those folks who are a little older who are into cool science and into technology, we kind of get it a little bit quicker. And then, of course, the younger generation, which, you know, they were the natives, and a lot of people don't like that term, but they grew up with it all along, so it's a little easier for them. And, you know, let me ask you this question, Lynn. When you went to that website, what did it do to you emotionally? And you didn't see... Right.
I found myself being very intolerant and very impatient, and I found it kind of hilarious, really, that they had on their website their phone number, and I thought, oh, I guess they must want to give me their phone number so that I can call them to ask them what their hours of operation are.
Jay, she has quite a temper.
well, but I mean, let's think about the psychology of that, right? I mean, here we are talking about websites some 20 years later, and you know, we still have people who are not using them, and when they do use them, they're not really thinking about the psychology of the consumer or the negative or positive effects it can have by not having certain information on those websites.
Yeah. Jay, it's common sense that in business we want to build relationships, and forgetting social media just for a moment, we seem to do okay in the outside world in trying to get to know our customers, our suspects, prospects, you know, those sorts of things as we go along in our marketing activities. But we don't do a very good job through social media. And that is that the basic premise of this book?
Well, it's one of the premises. I don't know if it's the basic premise. I think what's happened is we're trying to apply traditional marketing methods to a set of cultures and mediums that are not traditional at all. They are interactive, communicative cultures.
Right.
We're not TV, we're not radio, we're not print advertising where we can just shout at you like a billboard advertisement. They require interaction. And so when we try to apply these traditional marketing methods, well, they meet with a lot of psychological reactants, which is we will do things to turn them off because that's not what we're there for.
Right. Can you talk about some of the common myths in social media?
Well, I think the first myth is one that I just brought up, and that is, well, it's just another form of media that I can apply my own promotional strategy or my own advertising strategy, and it's going to be effective. And it's clearly not. The research has demonstrated that it's not. That's one myth. I think the other myth that I commonly see is that people with wealth don't use social media, and actually that has been the furthest from the truth. Facebook is still the number one platform for millionaires, way above LinkedIn or Twitter. I think that's a huge myth. Hmm. I think the other myth is that, you know, I just don't have the time to do it. It's one more thing that I have to do. And quite frankly, it's not. It's actually much quicker than using the phone or writing an email and being able to stay in touch and follow up, and makes it much easier actually to run your business or even get a career or help your organization.
And Jay, I believe you say that it's best to break it down into chunks and maybe attack it a couple times a day, maybe, or several times a day, 15-minute increments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you could do this in 10 to 15-minute increments. And at least, well, I don't think. I know because I've made my wife do it, and she's doing quite well with it. Mm-hmm. But she does 10 minutes in the morning with her cup of coffee when she's up, checking her email. She does her social media, and she gets on her phone at lunch while she's having her salad. And right before bed, she does another 10 to 15 minutes. So you could do this in about 30 to 45 minutes a day and stay in touch with, you know, tons of people that you just wouldn't have the time for otherwise.
Hmm. I'd like you to comment, Jay, on, you know, it seems like small businesses now, you know, building a website can cost you $5,000, $10,000, $20,000. However, a Facebook page can be pretty effective, and it's free, right? And I'm just wondering about the difference. Now, sometimes I tend to look up a business first on Facebook because I know it's a platform that, you know, most of us use. Of course, I could be wrong just saying that. Maybe I'm assuming most people in my generation and peer group use.
Well, I think what we do is we use now the Facebook page as the first stop, or at least we're doing that more so now,
okay,
rather than going to the web page. So we'll go to the Twitter profile, or we'll go to the Facebook page, or maybe even the LinkedIn page, which, by the way, are all free. And what we'll do is we will try to look there first, see if we gather enough information. Then will move on to the website to get the rest of the information, or the rest of the story, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I think we're starting to see that shift in consumer behavior.
Okay, okay. So this leads me into a question about Twitter. And you say that Twitter is the most misunderstood of all the social media platforms. And I will say that I just don't get it either. So I'm one of those people who misunderstand it. So I guess my question is, why?
Well, we really don't know what to do with Twitter. The average person really doesn't. It really is about parasocial contact. I think I can sum up Twitter in one profile on Twitter, and that's Beyonce's profile. She's been on Twitter for about 6 years. She's made 8 total tweets. She follows 8 people. She has 13.4 million followers. So if you haven't said anything and you're not following anybody, why do you have 13.4 million followers? Well, in psychology, we call that parasocial contact, where people follow celebrities or people with fame because they believe that they're part of their entourage. Right? I mean, why does Justin Bieber have 50 million people following him? I don't know. I don't know that Justin Bieber really has that much to say to me that I would want to follow him, but 50 million people do believe that. So that makes it kind of complicated for the average user, especially the average small business user, because they really don't have that fame or that status or that celebrity or media outlet to really have a foundation from. So it makes it more difficult to use, because Twitter is really 140 character language. And that makes it hard to really be interactive in 140 characters, mm-hmm. which is why it's really not all that social, which is why we don't get it. I think the average person really doesn't get it, because we've misunderstood that it's really not as social as we want to believe.
Jay, does Justin Bieber have anything to say to you?
Well, no, because I don't follow him.
Okay, good. I'm just having fun with you. I'm just wondering.
No. I don't know if he really does. I don't think he does. I'm not personally a fan of his music, but I mean, clearly there are 50 million people out there who are waiting for him to say something of use to them. I just wouldn't be one of them.
I think you mentioned in your book, which is interesting, that one of the founders of Twitter does not even believe they should call Twitter a social media.
Yeah, I found that really interesting too. That Dorsey, who was one of the original founders, said, I quoted his quote, and he said, Twitter's really not all that social. It's really kind of an informational portal. I mean, if we think about it, and we go back to looking at where the news is coming from, so many of us will go to Twitter first just to see the information because it seems to come out quicker.
Right.
Which is, by the way, is important for business, because even if you're not a Twitter user or Twitter tweeter, so to speak, you can find people who are actually looking for business in your area on Twitter just by doing a search. So even if you don't want to have any followers, search for keywords or phrases that people might use to find you or to find a product or service that you have to sell.
So I found it interesting in your discussion of LinkedIn, and LinkedIn has its own chapter, as all the different pieces do, how that can be used for business, and it is free. And also, interestingly, and people, it's sort of a taboo, is that you use Facebook for your personal connections, but you don't want to tout your business. It's really a taboo, and you stay close to people that you could eventually have a business relationship with.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it's about culture. LinkedIn is a business culture. So for most business people, right, psychologically, we feel more comfortable there because it's kind of like a networking event that we're kind of used to, with a few nuances. Facebook, gives us the clue of what Facebook's about culturally, because we connect as friends. So it's about being friendly. It's about being personal. It's about connecting in an authentic, real way. that allows us to create real relationships, which you can do in these cultures, and then they transfer over into real business.
Mm-hmm. This is one of the fallacies, I think, of people when they choose between Facebook and LinkedIn. And again, it's like you say, knowing your consumer or your user. Occasionally, I'll get a Facebook request from someone that I only do business with, and I think it's so bizarre. You know, and I wonder why, you know, are they, is it that they want to be my friend and not just my business associate, or is it they're just not getting the platform?
Well, and maybe something else. They may have enjoyed the experience with you in the business relationship first so well that they now want to become a personal friend of yours.
And that hadn't occurred to me.
And that they want to stay in touch with you, and that what they want to do is they want to be able to get to know you on a much deeper level, which is cool to me because, I mean, that's what relationships are about. And here's the other piece. For you, I would start creating a client list in my Facebook, on my Facebook profile, where, you know, you could put people in certain lists. And then that way you can click on that list of people you've done business with, and you can stay in touch with them, which is a great way to follow up and stay in touch with those past clients or current clients that you have, which you could not do on the phone because you could stay up with birthdays, new babies, new dogs, and life, and stay in touch so that it's more personal rather than just a professional relationship.
Huh. Yeah, that's interesting. And I suppose you would have to even organize your Facebook lists if you were to get really, organized about it and come up with certain posts that don't go to your client list, you know, or certain posts that only go to your, you know, your very close personal friends, which
right.
I think most of us don't do that.
Yeah, no, I don't think we do either. I mean, on a very micro level, by creating those lists, we can kind of control what information we put out, and which is a good thing on many occasions. But then also, you know, by having those lists, it allows us to kind of organize our lives a little bit easier, you know, and put things in priority that we want to, that who we need to look at, want to look at, and, you know, share information, specific information with.
So, Jay, what practical advice would you have for the business person that has not really gotten involved in social media but would like to start to do that, as far as just some good practical advice?
Okay, well, the first thing, I go completely against the gurus and the experts. You don't have to be on every social media platform. That's my very first piece of advice. Mm-hmm. Find out where your current consumers are. Survey them. Find out what. Are they using Facebook? Are they using LinkedIn? Are they using Twitter? Are they using Pinterest, Google+, whatever it might be? And then spend your time there. You know, that's where you want to spend the bulk of your time. And then secondly, my piece of advice is don't be overwhelmed with the technology. The human mind cannot keep up with the speed of technology. It's just not possible. And so focus on the people, not the technological changes. Because as people, we've pretty much stayed the same. We still respond to personal relationships, to authenticity, to genuineness, to being real. Focus on the people, not on the technology. And then finally, I would say, organize your day a little bit. You know, you don't have to be on here hours a day. You don't even need to be on there an hour. Just organize yourself in small chunks, small pieces, and then do it. And then finally, I'm going to say this. Start with LinkedIn. If you're not on, start with LinkedIn. It's going to feel familiar. It's going to be easier to start with, and it will help bridge the gap to the other social media platforms.
You also had some really good advice on LinkedIn for eventually joining groups and and the utility of doing that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, Dr. Cialdini, Robert Cialdini from Arizona State University, has done some tremendous research on the power of influence. And one of the psychological pieces that he talks about is the power of authority and credibility. And the one thing that LinkedIn groups do for you is they create authority and credibility based on your knowledge. And you can't do that anywhere else unless you're involved with groups where you can demonstrate that authority, demonstrate that expertise, demonstrate that credibility. does is that starts to draw people to you and gets people to want to know more about you. And it even translates into business, as I wrote in the book, you know, even about a B2B business broker who, because he was involved with groups, you know, wound up, you know, getting business because of what he wrote in the discussion sections.
That's very interesting. You know, I'm a little suspicious of LinkedIn, and I've asked this question before of someone we've interviewed, and I didn't really get an answer. He was actually someone that worked in the marketing department for LinkedIn, but maybe you have an answer. I find, and I think other people do too, that I get endorsed for my skills and expertise you know, in areas that I don't even have skills and expertise. You know, so it may be something, you know, I'm in media, but I'm in radio. So it may be something like, you've been endorsed for your video production skills by so-and-so. And I'm like, I'm not buying it. So is LinkedIn sincere?
Well, I do think it's sincere. Endorsements in the consumer psychology literature, we talk about numerosity. And numerosity is how psychologically we are drawn to large numbers. Okay, so endorsements do actually play a big psychological role, because the larger those numbers, the more we're drawn to it versus somebody who may have lower numbers. I know that doesn't seem right, doesn't seem fair, but it's really what we do as humans. We're just drawn to somebody who has 99 plus in media versus 37. We're going to give them more authority, more credibility. Well, LinkedIn does have a problem because people are being endorsed for things that, well, quite frankly, sometimes they don't know. And sometimes it's the person who's just allowing that to happen because they don't know better. Because you don't have to accept any endorsements for anything you don't want to be on your profile. So you can deny that request of that endorsement. And I am very, very, very clear. Put down in your profile only the things that you want to be endorsed for. And you can edit that in your profile so that if something out of the blue comes out, you can reject that, and that will probably cause the person actually to endorse you for something that you would rather be endorsed for.
Interesting. In addition, I think that it tries to build contacts for you. In other words, I've gotten this repeated invitation on LinkedIn from someone who I know did not send that invitation. I looked this up and I found all accounts of people saying, well, my boss that fired me just last week suddenly sent me a LinkedIn invitation, and I know that didn't happen. And, you know, I'm just curious about why LinkedIn, why they do that. I mean, I guess it goes back to the psychology of trying to make someone feel good about and look good.
Well, I think, you know, there's some confusion there, because I think what happens is LinkedIn, although I have no proof of this, but what they do is they make these suggested connections that now seem to appear like connect with me. And now that's not really what's happening. It's just that they put them in a position where it looks like they're asking to connect. Well, that's not really true. It's really that these are people like the people that you have on your already connected with. And so it looks like they're saying, okay, connect with this person, when in reality they're really not. And, you know, here's the thing about LinkedIn and connections. First of all, it's a business platform. It's a business culture. Connect or don't connect. You know, it's a business decision. So, you know, make a corporate decision and decide, no, I'm not connecting with you. And if you want to, click the little check mark and connect with them. You just have to make those decisions.
Jay, I'm intrigued with Google Plus. There are a lot of people that use it. I really don't know very much about it. Can you tell us about it?
Well, of course, Google Plus is Google's social media platform. I would try to describe it right now as a cross between bloated Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. It kind of combines all those parts. You can have a business page for free. You can have a personal page for free. But what I have found about Google Plus that seems to be pretty robust is that when you write a post in Google Plus and you know, you're using key terms and key search terms. My Google Plus posts will show up in the search results quite frequently.
Right.
And so there is, while Google will never come out and say this, there does seem to be some power in Google Plus from a search standpoint that the other platforms just don't have, based on my experience and my own anecdotal evidence, and actually the evidence of other colleagues that I have out there. It's pretty robust to use it. Now, it's not as friendly. It's not as Facebook. It's not as cold as LinkedIn, and it's certainly longer than Twitter. So it does have a kind of a weird feel, and you're kind of trying to figure out who's really on there, who's really using it. We seem to see more engineers, higher educated people with, you know, degrees using it quite frequently, and it's pretty male dominated, to be quite frank with you. So you know, it's still kind of a culture that hasn't died, in spite of what everybody is saying. And I think it has some validity, quite honestly.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jay Izzo, who's the internet doctor, written a fascinating book, Got Social Mediology. Jay, also wanted to mention that you wrote in your book that LinkedIn has tremendous Google search strength, in that if you have a LinkedIn account, it will typically show up before your own website in a search.
Well, a lot of times that is really happening for folks, that your name will pop up before your name will on your own website, which is just a cool thing, especially for a small business who doesn't have a marketing budget, right? I mean, being able to come up on the first page, and this has been something that's been going on with LinkedIn for years. I've watched this trend for years, where people have built a profile, and I don't know if it has to do with complete profiles, because LinkedIn and Google really doesn't tell us a lot about that. But it's amazing to me that you could type in a person's name and their LinkedIn profile will come up ahead many times above their own website. And it just tells you the power of LinkedIn and Google and how they feel about that link authority.
Right. Jay, I've just got one final question for you before we let you go. And that's about, you know, it comes back to search engine optimization. And, you know, a while back, people felt like they had to do a blog because that gave you better positioning for your website. And I'm just wondering if that is still, you know, if LinkedIn is so easy and efficient and gets you at the top of the list, you know, why do a blog? Because blogs are, you know, some are interesting, but if you're just doing them for the sake of having better search position, then I don't know. Is it worth it?
Oh, you need to be blogging in some form or another. I mean, LinkedIn has a tremendous blogging platform that they will connect up with Pulse.me, which is very, very powerful. But let me tell you why blogging is important. It is because people are no longer searching for best real estate agent in Lake Park, Utah. What they're now searching for is, how do I relocate to Lake Park, Utah? So you may want to start writing blogs about how-tos, whys, questions that people would be asking, and be the expert to answer those questions, because that's how people are starting to search now. We're no longer looking for the best. We're no longer looking for number one. We're now looking for people who have expertise, credibility, authority, and can answer the questions that we are asking. And that's going to come through your blogging platform more so than it's going to come through SEO websites or some other form of spending money. And it's free. There's so many great free platforms, WordPress, Blogspot. I mean, you've got a bunch of great platforms out there.
Right. So instead of writing something cutesy in your blog, think again about your consumer and the information they want. Be the expert.
Jay, I just wanted to mention very quickly that there's a lot of books out there on social media, and I found this one to be really straightforward. It wasn't overhyped. It was really good practical information for how to market your business. And, you know, I just enjoyed the book, so thank you.
You know what? Thank you so much for saying that. I wrote it with the intention that we're sitting over our favorite beverage and some meat and some cheese, and I was just going to have a good time trying to explain it to you. And you don't sound like a social media curmudgeon, which is really, really good to me.
Very good. All right, Jay Izzo, the Internet Doctor, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, and please, the book's available nationally, so if it's not in your favorite bookstore, just ask for it. Got Social Mediology, and it's available on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, Target.com, Kindle, iBook, Nook, so however you want to find it, please
it's there.
It.
Okay.
It's there.
All thanks, right, Jay. Thanks, Jay. Again, that was Jay Izzo with Got Social Mediology, Using Psychology to Master Social Media for Your Business Without Spending a Dime. That was very informational. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll be speaking with a computer scientist from the University of Utah, and he's also the coordinator of a new program. It's a graduate certificate program there, all about big data. It's Jeff Phillips coming up next. Stay with us.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, formerly Prudential, Utah. We have been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976 and have been proud supporters of KPCW since its beginning. More information can be found at bhhsutah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We're just talking with Jeff Izzo, the Internet Doctor, with his book, Got Social Mediology. And now we'll bring it on back home to Utah and the University of Utah that has a highly regarded engineering program within also a highly regarded computer science department that's now been bolstered by the addition of a new graduate certificate program in big data analysis. Joining us to talk about what goes into the making of the program, why we need it, all of those sorts of things, is Jeff Phillips, professor of computer science and coordinator of the program. Professor Phillips, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Do we have?
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks.
Exciting program you've just announced.
Oh, great. Yeah. So, so it's just a program we started this year, and so it's mainly for people who have been working as computer science or engineers, but don't really have the skills to deal with the large sources of data, which are now becoming one of the main drivers of most of the industry. So we've made this program so people can go back and get some more education on how to become experts in these areas.
Right, and you also you currently have courses in data mining and machine learning and database systems visualization, advanced algorithms, those sorts of things. So this is really packaging this up and adding more of these types of courses. Will this be a master's in data analysis?
So we also offer a master's and we also offer a PhD in these areas, but
okay.
The new, so we've had those only for about 3 or 4 years as well. So we hired a lot of new faculty in this area who are experts in these areas, and we've started training kind of these master's and other graduate students, and these people have been starting to enter the workforce. But the thing we found is there's a lot of people who've been working and kind of want to go back and hone up their skills, but a master's is, especially in this area, you know, this stuff is not always easy, and so it's not the same commitment as the master's, and we've been trying to make it so that these courses are accessible to people who are working full time, so they can take these as they're working.
Right. And Jeff, wondering, you know, big data means a lot of different things to different people.
Right.
How do you define it there? And you know, maybe to tack on to that question, why is there a problem with knowing how to handle big data?
So I don't think there's a problem. It's actually, you know, so it's a great thing to be able to do that. You know, so there's new challenges. And there are challenges for two reasons. The first one is that often with the scale, we've often, so the often the way of dealing with this data is you load it into like an Excel spreadsheet, or you run some statistical package, and often the size of this data or kind of the rate at which it's updating is faster than these traditional packages can handle. So there's been new technologies and there's been new kind of concepts in science at how to take some of these techniques and scale them up. And not all the techniques scale up to the large data. The other sort of thing is that it used to be that you had a small amount of data. You could do like a survey of your customers. You get maybe a few hundred surveys. And you'd kind of try and make predictions for your entire customer base based on these few hundred. Now there are ways of kind of monitoring all the transactions that your business is having, or if you're a scientist, kind of looking at a much richer set of data, and you can draw much more complex conclusions than before. And so this requires, sometimes the older techniques can kind of work for this, but there are new kind of, there are new sort of phenomena that are happening at scale that were not happening on the smaller data sets. We're able to draw these more complex and, you know, kind of conclusions. And this has had some really interesting effects on both business and also in science.
Wow, that's interesting. Also, I'm wondering, at the University of Utah, I'm always curious about when a new program is introduced or it's bolstered in some way. Are you forming partnerships? Is it being helped out by any corporations?
So we've been in discussion with some corporations, and kind of one of the main thing we've been doing is we're actually trying to cater to a lot of the local corporations. So we have students from Adobe and from Ancestry.com who are taking our classes. We've been trying to work with the companies to make sure that it's easy for the students to take the courses,
right?
And that the courses are kind of suiting the needs of the companies and the students. And we're trying to expand this to, you know, to other companies as well.
About half of my career was in high-performance, reliable, available storage and storage systems and subsystems, a company called Network Appliance. And,
yeah.
You know, I'm so excited about some of the things that are coming out of big data. I just wanted to take a moment and just sort of set the stage for everyone so everyone can understand the strategic nature of this. We have data that we're streaming every day from our phones, our credit cards, computers. We have sensor-equipped buildings, trains, buses, planes, bridges, all of that. And the data flow is so fast that the total accumulation just the last 2 years is a zettabyte. And the zettabyte dwarfs the prior record of all human civilization. So that's just in the last 2 years. Give everybody a little perspective on what a zettabyte is. A gigabyte is a billion bytes of data. 1,000 billion bytes of data is a terabyte. 1,000 terabytes is a petabyte, or a quadrillion bytes of information. And finally, there are 1,000, another way of saying 1 million petabytes in a zettabyte. So a zettabyte has been accumulated in the last 2 years. Again, it dwarfs the prior record of human civilization. We have more data than we know what to do with. And by mining this in smart, sophisticated ways, by using algorithms and all sorts of other techniques, we're able to gather all sorts of information we had no idea was out there.
So, yeah, that's right. So maybe I can give another example that might help put this information in perspective. You know, if you think about, you know, humans, usually we only know a handful of people ourselves. You know, we interact and we have these friends and neighbors we interact with. Maybe it's a few hundred.
Mm-hmm.
Now through the web, we can get information about maybe every other person out there, or at least these companies can. So instead of, say, you know, 5 billion people or, you know, maybe like a billion people in the civilized world, now you think about this number squared is the amount of information we have. Right, so instead of having a little bit of local information, everyone now has global information that's at their fingertips. And these relationships are building new structure and new kind of consequences for companies and advertising, and it's, there's a lot of very interesting stuff going on.
Okay, those are all, in fact, my head spinning from John's explanation there. It just sounds like an infinite amount of data really is what it is. I'm wondering a little bit about some interesting, you know, you're introducing this program or this certificate. What are some of the courses offered that we may not know even exist?
The thing I found is that the courses, you know, are mainly on things people have maybe heard the words like machine learning or data mining, or maybe even algorithms. These words are now in TV shows, mm-hmm. where, like, you know, 10 years ago this would be rare. But often still people don't really know what these things are. I found even sometimes the students coming in who are, you know, taking and learning about this don't know really what is the difference between, say, machine learning and data mining. So we also have classes on advanced topics of these, but we start with these concepts. So I could explain kind of like what machine learning is. Is that?
Yeah, why don't you go over that? It's sort of a new term to me.
Yeah, so, you know, so what machine learning is the ability to take some data about some, say, if you're a company, some data about some customers you've had in the past, and look at, say, how you've monetized these customers, whether they've bought some product or they haven't. And then when you get some new sort of maybe customers who are coming to your website and they haven't bought something or not yet, you want to try and predict whether they will buy something. And so this starts to be useful when you can say, well, what happens if I have a price point which is different, then can I predict if I change that price point, will that change my prediction? And so it's trying to learn based on past data, you know, what's going to happen in the future. And so this field grew out of this idea of trying to understand, like, intelligence, but this has been a kind of a very concrete application of it that has taken off.
Yeah, that's a great explanation. And, you know, it makes me wonder about, you know, how many businesses are out there, small businesses, I'm sure there are many out there, corporations less so, that have no idea that they need this sort of data mining.
Yeah, so, you know, this is a lot of small businesses are relying on there are other companies out there which can provide services where they'll allow you to they'll hook into your data and try and make predictions for you. And so this kind of goes so far, but you need kind of the challenge is then understanding the output of what these other companies are telling you. And so if you don't have someone trained in machine learning, you may not be able to actually kind of like fully appreciate or interpret these results. You know, I've been talking to more and more of the local companies, and a lot of them are saying, now that I have this data, you know, I'm not sure what to do with it. And so they're kind of looking for ways to learn from it and to kind of expand their business from it.
Well, data is strategic. And for a small business or a medium-sized business, there's a lot of information that you can glean out of taking a look at the data. What's most fascinating to me is a larger picture, predicting where and when crimes may be more likely to occur, finding associations between different things like air quality and health. I mean, I'm fascinated. I mean, I know a lot of people keep texting me pictures of a meatball they made last night, but there are a billion social media posts every 2 days. And And I know that has been looked at recently in China, looking at all the Chinese posts. And there's all sorts of information we can learn. Lynn and I had someone on our show some time ago that even talked about, and you're probably familiar with this study, when Google was able to contact the CDC in Atlanta when the bird flu was out with a whole series of data on where they would predict the bird flu would break out next, region by region, and just based on the trillions of bytes of information that they analyzed on people that were using Google searches to find out symptoms and those sorts of things. So there's there's a lot of fascinating things out there. And in our state, Utah, NSA, of course, is going to have that large facility. By using data mining, and I know a lot of people are a little sensitive about NSA, but I think that there's so much that they can learn, that we can learn as a country, about what's going on outside of this country by doing a better job of analyzing data.
Yeah, so, you know, the stuff going on with NSA is very controversial, but, you know, as you point out, it's hard to separate these benefits that we're now that we're now taking for granted, with these other things that we may not like, which are these side effects. So, for instance, a company can now put targeted ads when you're searching the web. If you were searching for like a new car, then all of a sudden, you know, you're looking for this online. All of a sudden, your ads wherever you search is going to be about these cars. And so some people find this creepy, but I think the fraction of people who found this creepy has kind of gone down. People have accepted it, and now it's actually useful. Instead of getting these random advertisements, which don't have, you know, aren't useful for you, you're getting things which are actually providing you information, which may help you make a better purchase.
Right.
That's so interesting. I actually just, you know, that happens to me all the time. And it's usually something that I've had a whim about purchasing, but I get over it before I purchase it. So it is really annoying to me to have them badgering me with information. However, I just went on a lovely vacation, and it's almost like I'm going on the vacation again because I get back to work and I'm still badgered with all these great places I can stay and what I can do while I'm there. And I love it this week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're going to have some ads on the web page anyways. It's now, because you were searching for that, the ads are something that are, you know, somehow more relevant to you.
Yes.
Jeff, I'm curious. Human beings are so much better than computers at seeing patterns. As far as visualizing data and linking data sets and coming up with useful information, how do we merge, or how do we bring the two together, the computer age and the ability that humans have to be able to recognize patterns?
Yeah, so there are two sides to this. So, yeah, so humans are great at picking these patterns out of this, you know, visual presentation of data. But now the challenge is we're having so much data, you have to wrangle it into some sort of visual way of seeing it that you can find the pattern. It used to be you had these small data sets. You could plot, you know, 1,000 data points and kind of look for patterns. But now if you have 1,000,000 data points, they kind of fill up the whole graph and you can't see anything anymore. So you need to kind of find ways to represent this data so it's not overwhelmed by the noise of the data. And so there are new techniques out there, and we have programs at the UN. Part of this certificate program has a class training people on how to understand how to visualize these large data sets effectively. But there's also another side of the coin. Humans are sometimes almost too good at picking out patterns, and we'll see things which are not actually there. One way you may kind of have come across this in the past is if you see these optical illusions. These are ways where the humans are good at seeing certain types of patterns, but it'll make you believe something is there even if it's not.
Right.
And the same thing happens when looking at these complex data sets. And so what's needed is that you should be able to statistically validate any sort of pattern that you're trying to find. Otherwise, you'll start kind of spotting things which aren't actually there. You'll start seeing kind of like these ghosts in the bushes and stuff. But
exactly.
This can happen in science. And in like large-scale science, this is actually a large problem. We're getting such massive amounts of new data that you get these scientists looking for these patterns, and sometimes they'll see patterns which aren't actually there, and they'll write papers about them and say, here's this cool new phenomenon that I've observed. But if you kind of are more careful with the statistics, you may realize it's not actually there. It was just an artifact of having all this data, and it happened to be that this part of the noisy part of the data looked like a pattern.
Exactly. You know, we're very fortunate to be here in Utah with Utah State University and Brigham Young University, and of course Utah, the University of Utah, and the computer science program and the engineering department that you have down at the university. It's just incredible. So we want to thank you so much for joining us. This is a new certificate program. It's a master's in big data, also a PhD program. And it's a new engineering certificate at the University of Utah. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, okay. Jeff.
We shall return after these messages, and we may even have time for today's cool story.
Nexus IT is proud to support Cool Science Radio and KPCW. Nexus IT provides complete cloud computing solutions to streamline and simplify your business, IT processes, and logistics. 435-487-9099. NexusITC.net.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. We want to thank our two guests today, Jay Izzo, Got Social Mediology, and also Jeff Phillips, computer science professor from the University of Utah. And, you know, this is what I love about you, John. There are many things I love about you. You're a great co-host. And, you know, many of us, most of us, remember things in our lives. Like, we can remember where we were when we heard that Elvis died.
Right.
And when Michael Jackson died, where we were, what we were doing. Now, before the show, we were talking about where you were when what happened back in 1972.
In 1972, I was reading an article in the Wall Street Journal about the first black hole that had ever been detected. It was in the Virgo system. It was called Cygnus X1, which is Latin for Signal 11. I was at my buddy Chet Blackie's house, and I'll just never forget it, because when it came out, they had theorized that black holes were possible, but they had no idea, and they found this thing, and they didn't know what to think.
Right. And so since then, 1972, every time you read about a black hole and a new discovery of a black hole, as we have read about this week,
yeah,
you are mesmerized.
I am. I'm stupefied.
That is so great. Most of us don't even know what a black hole is, but here we go. This is a great representation of what it is. Very simply, it's a dense region of space that's collapsed in on itself in a way that means nothing can escape it, not even light. And this week in the news, researchers in China have spotted a supermassive black hole, not just any old black hole. It's 12 billion times the size of the sun. And
yes,
it's also been there for a long time.
Yeah. It's not the largest that they've ever detected, but it is the largest for its age, because usually it takes a lot longer, because black holes, through their tremendous gravitational pull, are sucking in star systems and galaxies to make them larger. And this is a relatively young black hole, 900 million years old, versus some of these other ones that are much older.
Billions.
Yeah.
Ah, very interesting. So that was the news from this week on black hole that got John excited. And here's something that, you know, I was looking for, how to really make big data relevant to our lives. And I was looking around while we're talking to Jeff. This one is big data to track the increase in marijuana's THC content.
Ooh.
So that is one application. I'm sure those University of Utah students, you know, find that, oh, this is relevant to my life. It
yes,
turns out. And this is, you know, since a lot of the legalization of marijuana, like in Colorado, and even like they're talking about here, In 1995, 4% THC concentration, up to now 12% in 2013.
Boy,
so there
amazing.
You go.
Amazing.
Need to wrap it up here. Thank our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, and Nexus IT. You're listening to KPCW Park City.
Loretta Lynch's nomination for Attorney General is endorsed by the Senate Judiciary Committee and now moves to the full Senate for confirmation. The committee voted today 12-8. Despite a breakdown in diplomatic ties between Paris and Damascus, several French lawmakers have met privately with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley says that's drawing scathing criticism from the Prime Minister of France.
They didn't just go meet anybody, said Prime Minister Manuel Valls, speaking on French radio. They went to meet Bashar al-Assad, who's responsible for tens of thousands of deaths. Valls called it a visit to a butcher and a huge moral mistake. The four parliamentarians from both the left and right met with Assad for about an hour Wednesday. Syrian officials rolled out the red carpet and publicized the visit, much to the annoyance of the French government. France supports the moderate Syrian opposition and wants Assad to leave power. But voices are rising in Western capitals to re-engage with Assad. He is increasingly viewed as the lesser of two evils when compared with Islamic State. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Israeli police are investigating a fire at a Christian seminary as a possible hate crime. NPR's Emily Harris reports from Jerusalem. This follows a similar attack on a mosque.
The mosque is in a Palestinian town in the West Bank. The Greek Orthodox Seminary is in Jerusalem's Old City. In both cases, there was limited damage to the buildings and no one was hurt. Insulting graffiti was spray-painted in Hebrew on the walls in both places. In the past, similar attacks have been attributed to extremist Jewish groups. Jerusalem's mayor condemned the attack on the seminary, saying police must restore peace to the city. Leading Palestinian peace negotiator Saeb Erekat called both attacks Israeli terrorism and said the Israeli government is responsible. Emily Harris, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In Thailand, a committee appointed by the country's military rulers says the new 200-member Senate won't be directly elected by the people. Michael Sullivan reports from Thailand. Critics are calling the decision a setback to the return of democratic rule.
When the Thai military seized power last May, it scrapped the country's constitution and tasked a 36-member committee to draft a new one. That committee has decided the new senators will be chosen from a pool of candidates that will include former military leaders, former high-ranking government officials, and others. It's not clear who will do the choosing. Critics say the decision is an attempt by the military to limit the power of elected officials in the future. Parties closely tied to former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, ousted in a 2006 coup, have won landslide victories in every general election since, including the one in 2011, that brought his sister, Yingluck, to power. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai.
Dow is off 3 points at 18,222. This is NPR News. Washington, D.C. leaders may be threatened with prison, but so far it's not changing their minds about pot. Mayor Muriel Bowser has allowed a voter-approved initiative on marijuana possession to take effect. Shortly after midnight, it became legal in D.C. for residents to possess up to 2 ounces of pot so long as they use it at home, not in public. Residents are now also allowed to grow up to 3 mature marijuana plants. Well, congressional Republicans who sought to keep the initiative from taking effect warn that the mayor is violating federal law. A major winter storm is pummeling southern states. Residents of central North Carolina are digging out. The region received 5 inches of snow already. It's causing power problems across the state. For member station WFDD, Carrie Brown has the latest.
Governor Pat McCrory has declared a state of emergency in North Carolina and is urging motorists to stay off the roads as crews work to plow and salt them. Larry Kirby with the village of Clem.